Good afternoon, members. The Healthcare Appropriations Subcommittee will now come to order. Members, please turn on your microphones when responding to roll call. Sabrina, please call the roll.
Chair Avila.
Here.
Vice Chair Yarborough.
Here.
Representatives Altman.
Here.
Barnaby.
Here.
Ranking Member Brown.
Here.
Representatives Driscoll. Duran.
Here.
Harding.
Here.
Robinson.
Here.
Salzman.
Here.
Saroy, excused. Representative Skidmore.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
Snyder.
Here.
Trabulsi.
Here.
Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Sabrina. Quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Healthcare Appropriations Subcommittee. Please make sure that all cell phones and other electronic communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. Members, today we have two agenda items for our meeting. The Agency for Healthcare Administration will make a presentation on supplemental payment programs, and we will also take up our first consent agenda for appropriation project bills. So first, we are going to start out with the consent agenda. So members, we will take up the consent agenda and vote once on the agenda in its entirety. The public is welcome to testify on any of the bills listed on the consent agenda. Members, we will not take up question, debate, and vote on each of the bills individually. Instead, we will be in questions and debate only once on the entirety of the consent agenda. Remember, you may vote no on any particular bill by submitting a no vote / consent agenda form with the administrative assistant before the vote. If someone would care to request one, we will gladly give them a one of those forms. With that being said, are there any questions? Any questions on the consent agenda? Any questions on the consent agenda? Any questions on the consent agenda? Any public testimony? Any public testimony on the consent agenda? Is there debate? Is there debate? Okay. So members, before I call the vote on the consent agenda, are there any nay vote forms that anyone would like to request at this time? One thing that I do want to add is that passing the bill simply, so these bills in the consent agenda, simply passing them makes them eligible for the budget. However, it does not guarantee that these bills will be funded in the budget. It also does not mean that they will be funded at the requested level. So I just want all of the members to keep that in mind. This is simply making it so that these appropriations requests can be eligible for funding if that is the case later on throughout the process. So with that being said, Sabrina, will you please call the roll on the consent agenda? Remember, a yes vote signifies an affirmative vote for every bill on the consent agenda, with the exception of any no votes on the particular bill that were just announced. So with that, Sabrina, please call the roll.
Okay. Chair Avila.
Yes.
Vice Chair Yarborough.
Yes.
Representatives Altman.
Yes.
Barnaby.
Yes.
Ranking Member Brown.
Yes.
Representatives Driscoll.
Yes.
Duran.
Yes.
Harding.
Yes.
Robinson.
Yes.
Salzman.
Yes.
Saroy, excused. Skidmore.
Yes.
Smith.
Yes.
Snyder.
Yes.
Trabulsi.
Yes.
There are 14 yeas, Chair.
Thank you, Sabrina and members. By your vote, please show that all of the bills on the consent agenda will be reported favorably. Next, members, the Agency for Healthcare Administration will make a presentation on supplemental payment programs. This presentation will include an overview of each supplemental payment program that the agency administers, including the graduate medical education, as well as the directed payment program, which was proposed in the governor's recommended budget proposal. Please welcome Mr. Tom Wallace back to our committee, the Assistant Deputy Secretary for Medicaid Finance and Analytics. I also would like to mention to all of the members, I know last meeting, we got a little tight towards the end. And so you certainly will have the opportunity to ask Mr. Wallace questions. Please make sure just to keep those questions Mr. Wallace, towards the subject matter, right? Make sure that obviously you are asking questions, not that you already know, but questions that obviously will be fruitful to the committee and to all of the members as well as to the public. So with that being said, Mr. Wallace, welcome to the Healthcare Appropriations Committee. Thank you for being here.
Great, thank you. And good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to kind of walk through with you guys and provide you a high-level overview of supplemental Medicaid payments. You'll have this overview, and I think you'll get a lot out of it. These are additional payments that we make to a lot of our Medicaid providers. So this is just a listing. I want to start with this so you could see exactly the programs that we have here. And so these are the following programs you'll learn about. The first one's going to be the low-income pool program. The disproportionate share program is next. Then you have the graduate medical education program, the physician supplemental payment program, the multivisceral transplant program, the Florida Cancer Hospital payment program, the public emergency medical transportation, and then last, we're going to have a little discussion around the DPP program or directed payment program. This is what's being proposed currently. Those top seven programs, when you add all that funding together, we're looking at about $2.23 billion in total computable funding. And so as we go through this, you'll see more specifics on that per each of the programs. So I want to start off with just in general stating what supplemental payment programs are. And so these are payments made to Medicaid providers that are in addition to the Medicaid reimbursement that they receive for the services that are provided. So a hospital will be paid for an inpatient stay for a Medicaid recipient on that stay, and then this would be an additional payment on top of that stay for that example there to that hospital. The state share funding source is generally through non-general revenue funds. And then this is authorized by the legislature through statute or the General Appropriations Act or the proviso language and approved by the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services or CMS. So currently there are the eight supplemental payment programs that are either operationalized or being proposed. So the agency collects intergovernmental transfers to pay the state match for Medicaid supplemental payments. So this is the non-general revenue source of funds. These IGTs are the transfer of funds from governmental entities other than Medicaid. So they can come from counties, local healthcare taxing districts, municipalities, and then providers operated by state and local governments. The entities planning on providing these IGTs need to sign what we call a letter of agreement, or LOA, with the agency each state fiscal year, stating the amount of funds that they plan on contributing to that program. These LOAs are due to the agency by October 1st of each year, as laid out in statute. And then the agency uses these IGTs to draw down the FMAP dollars, so the federal matching dollars here. So local government funds have supported the Medicaid programs all the way going back to 1992, beginning with the disproportionate share hospital program or the DSH program. The growth of the DSH program and the implementation of the low-income pool increased the need for these local governments to sustain these funds for both of these programs. And so this was was done back in 92, 93. If you look at that, we had three local governments to help fund the DISH program. And then in 17, 18, we had 41 local governments that helped fund the DISH program along with other supplemental payment programs. And then by current year in 2021, there's 97 local governments funding these same programs along with a few additional. Again, these local governments can be from the cities, taxing districts, counties, municipalities. So now let's talk about the first supplemental payment program here, the low-income pool, or LIP. So it began in 2006 as part of the Medicaid reform pilot. This was a waiver program. There was a Medicaid reform. It was a coordinated delivery system of care. It was really one of the first managed care programs that we had here in Florida. And it was started in Duval and Broward counties as a pilot and then expanded into Baker, Nassau, and Clay counties. And the low-income pool was a part of that. The original purpose of the LIP program is to provide supplemental funding to hospitals, clinics, and other entities to improve the access to healthcare services in rural communities, and then to also ensure the continued governmental support of the provisions of the healthcare services for the uninsured and the underinsured. So that was the original purpose. And since then, the current purpose is to provide governmental support for costs of the uncompensated care for low-income individuals who are uninsured. So the program switched a little bit. So that now it covers the cost of charity care. So how LIP works, it's funded by local governments. So these local government entities put in money into the pool through the IGTs. The agency uses those IGTs to draw down the FMAP on the federal or the federal share. And what happens is when the federal share changes, like we have right now with we have an enhanced FMAP of 6.2%, that benefits these providers drastically here. And so when the FMAP changes, the amount that can be drawn down obviously changes for the low-income pool. And just looking at the additional FMAP we have for current year, this is benefiting the providers in low-income pool by $174 million. Just on the hospital side, it's $144 million just from that increase in the FMAP. So the agency then distributes that combined local and federal dollars to these qualified providers based off of a legislative-approved distribution model that we have. Wanted to show you just the history of the LIP pool and the amounts of funding we were talking about. So in state fiscal years 2006 through 2007, and then through 13-14, the program was $1 billion. In 14-15, and then the next year, it's grown to 1.5 in 17-18, and then that's through 21-22. So we have authorization for $1.5 billion. So the low-income pool provisions for state fiscal years 17-18 through 29-30, and so you see 29-30 up here because this is recently on January 15th that Florida had received approval of the 1115 managed care waiver extension for 10 years. That's part of our managed medical assistance program, our managed care program, and LIP is a part of that. So it was extended out for additional 10 years through 2030. And so with that, we have more time here to continue the LIP program. So approximately $1.5 billion we know we want to have for 20 through 21-22. So the budget you guys will be working on, we will have authority for $1.5 billion. And then in state fiscal year 22-23, this year, a reassessment of the amount of uncompensated charity care costs will have to take place, and we'll update the LIP limit not to exceed the $2.17 billion. So there will be an assessment done. The agency, along with federal CMS, will work on that. We'll take into consideration the hospital's Medicare cost reports to determine what that value should be. And so another provision here, this is saying it was provide support of safety net providers through the cost of uncompensated care through low-income individuals who are uninsured. I've kind of already said that, just reiterating that again. It does not include uncompensated care costs for individuals who are insured, bad debt, or Medicaid or CHIP shortfall. And when we say shortfall, that is the difference between what Medicaid will pay or CHIP pays and then the provider's cost. So prior to 16-17 LIP, the Medicaid shortfall was covered under, could be a part of the LIP program, but now it's just strictly a charity care program. So there are a few provider groups that can receive LIP dollars besides hospitals. Hospitals are the largest one, but that's not all hospitals. So federally qualified health centers and or rural health clinics can receive from LIP dollars, medical school faculty physician practice plans, and community behavioral health providers can receive LIP dollars as well. So there are some flexibilities that we have in developing the LIP distribution model. So each of those groups above, those four groups, can be divided into five tiered subgroups. And each one of those tiered five subgroups can be based on if they're publicly owned, privately owned, statutory teaching, if they're a freestanding children's hospital, or if they're a RIPIC hospital status. So it can be based on ownership. Next, the group can be based on uncompensated charity care ratio. And this is what the provider's uncompensated charity care costs are as a percentage to their commercial cost, their total commercial cost. And then lastly, a more recent flexibility that CMS provided for the low-income pool has to do with FQHCs and RHCs, where the Section 330 Public Health Services Act grants an FQHC lookalike status. So those type of entities that meet that qualification can now be a part of the low-income pool. So with the low-income pool, CMS has some specific participation requirements that we need to adhere by, and all the facilities that want to receive dollars have to participate in here. And the first thing is all providers must be enrolled in Medicaid. That's the first thing here. Next, hospitals must contract with at least 50% of the standard Medicaid health plans that are in their region, and then at least one of the Medicaid specialty plans for each target population that is served by that specialty plan in that region. So under managed care program, we have some HIV/AIDS specialty plans, and then we have a serious mental illness specialty plan. So if that plan's in that region, that hospital must contract with them. Also, the hospitals must participate in the encounter notification system. We also call this as an ENS system. This system allows the health plans to gather some important information from the hospitals on discharges and other information on their members, admissions, ED visits, et cetera. And then those health plans can use that information to tell their provider groups and whatnot about that. So just information sharing from hospitals to the health plans. And then also hospitals must have at least a 1% Medicaid utilization. In terms of the medical school faculty physician practice plans, they must participate in what's called the Florida Medical School Quality Network. And this is a network that was created some time ago. It's been around here to develop quality metrics and improve outcomes of health plans. And then they also must have at least 1% Medicaid utilization. For the federally qualified health centers or rural health clinics, they must contract with at least 50% of all the Medicaid managed care plans in the region. And then the last participation requirement for community behavioral health providers is that they must be a designated central receiving system, and that consists of a designated central receiving facility and some other providers that serve as a single point for people needing evaluation for crisis stabilization and behavioral health needs or substance abuse. So right here what you see is actually the model here for hospitals and the tiering of the hospitals. So like I said, there's five tiers for the hospital LIP program, and they're broken out by what you see here for the different qualifications. And then that last column shows you the percent of charity care that is paid back to those hospitals. So the first one, tier one, is going to be made up of private hospitals with an uncompensated care ratio greater than or equal to 17% and less than 51.5%. And they get paid back 8.9% of their charity care. So we know what their charity care costs are, and they'll get reimbursed 8.9% of that. Tier two, this is made up of your big public hospitals, all the freestanding children's hospitals, your statutory teaching hospitals that have a UC ratio that is greater than or equal to 19%, and then private hospitals that's greater than or equal to 51.5%, they get paid back all of their charity care, 100% of it. Tier three, this is going to be made up of the statutory teaching hospitals with less than 19%. They get 58.4% back. Tier four is going to be RIPIC hospitals and statutory teaching RIPIC hospitals here with a UC ratio greater than or equal to 15%, less than 70%, so they get 100% as well paid back through LIP. And then lastly, all your remaining private hospitals that has less than 70% uncompensated care ratio, they get 1% paid back. For the other provider types, the medical school physician practices, they get paid 100% of their charity care back. FQHCs and RHCs, 18.7%, and then community behavioral health center receiving systems get 100%. So just going back here, looking at this chart, just so you have an idea, there's 174 hospitals that are in the LIP program for 2021. We have medical school practice plans, 5 of those, 49 FQHCs, and then 10 behavioral health providers. And this, I just want to show you what the funding looks like by the different groups. So all those hospital tiers all lumped together in this group one, $885 million for a grand total of a little over $1 billion, about $1.1 billion of the low-income pool. If you remember on an earlier slide, I mentioned that we have the authority for up to $1.5 billion of the low-income pool. We do, but we only can spend that authority if you receive the IGTs in. And so the hospitals had only provided enough IGTs to support $1.1 billion for this year. That takes us to the next supplemental payment program. And this is a disproportionate share hospital program. So DSH was created under federal law to compensate hospitals that have provided a disproportionate share of Medicaid or charity care services. And that federal law establishes an annual DSH allotment that each state has to adhere by, and it's based off the federal financial participation. And so each year around October, we will receive from the federal government how much they say our DSH allotment will be. It's a federal dollar amount, and we cannot exceed that paying out for the different DSH programs. So Florida began receiving IGTs to fund this program back in 92, 93, as I mentioned earlier. And then we have 73 hospitals that participate in these following 8 DSH categories. All these categories you see listed here are laid out in Florida statute, and there's different formulas and whatnot laid out there to direct the agency how to spread out that money. If you look at your General Appropriations Act each year, you guys do adopt a DSH model, and that is put in the back of the hospital funding supplemental document that is a part of the General Appropriations Act, and that's who we pay each year by each one of these categories. So although DSH is a federal program, state matching funds are required each year to distribute these payments, so they are funded with IGTs, except for these following categories. So rural DSH, it does use other fraud and abuse recoveries that the state receives, that the agency gets in, so we use that state cash as the state source. For mental health DSH, these are the hospitals that are run by our partners at Department of Children and Families. Those are the mental health state hospitals. They certify through a certified public expenditure the state share, and we're able to draw down federal match with that CPE. And then specialty DSH, that's DOH runs this. There's a hospital that has a specialty DSH program, and it's a CPE as well. And then the children's hospitals is funded with $6.5 million in general revenue that's appropriated for them. And here you can see the different programs for DSH and the amounts of money for each one of these programs for a total computable of $330 million. This is for 2021, so current year.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. We're going to just take a quick little, give you a little breather and take some questions now on LIP and DSH before we continue, just to obviously make sure that members are able to ask questions regarding the two topics that have been presented by Mr. Wallace, and also give him a chance to catch his breath here a little bit. So I believe we have Representative Skidmore for a question. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wallace. I have a question on, and I may have misunderstood you, so this may be a conversation we can have offline and you can help me understand. But in 2006, that I did not think that that's when LIP started. I thought that that was the pilot program for Broward and Duval, but that LIP we had implemented earlier. So can you help me understand that. I remember the pilot program for Broward and Duval for Medicaid managed care, and then we eventually, in 2011, passed that legislation to create the bifurcated system for long-term care and then Medicaid managed care. But I'm fuzzy on the LIP pool because I really thought that it was older than that. And like I said, it may be an offline conversation if it's too long of an explanation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Thank you. You're recognized.
Thank you for that question. I think I could try to address it here quickly, but happy to discuss with you later on, too, if you like. The LIP program did start and formed in 2006. Prior to the LIP program, we did have a different supplemental payment program. It was called the UPL, or the Upper Payment Limit Program. So that was around prior to LIP coming in 2006 with the Medicaid reform program.
Thank you, Representative. Members, any questions regarding LIP and DISH? Okay. Mr. Wallace, we'll move on to the graduate medical education.
Okay. So this is GME program, we like to call it, make it short. It consists of 8 programs. 3 years ago, we had just 2 programs, and those are the 2 that were sitting right here on this page. These we consider statutory programs because they are laid out in statute with the formula for calculating them. The first one is a statewide Medicaid residency program, and it's established to improve the quality of care and access to care for Medicaid recipients, to expand the graduate medical education on an equitable basis, and increase the supply of highly trained physicians statewide. This program is funded with general revenue and medical care trust fund dollars. It did begin in 12-13. So how this works, hospitals will submit to the agency a listing of their recipients in August, and by September 15th per statute each year, we need to calculate what that distribution is. To give you an idea how this program has grown, when it started in 12-13, we had 43 hospitals participating, and that covered 3,900 FTE resident slots. And then today, we now have 73 hospitals receiving these funds for 6,200 resident or FTE slots. Then you have the Startup Bonus Program. This provides funding to hospitals that have newly accredited physician residency positions or programs in the statewide supply and demand deficit for specialties or subspecialties. This program is funded with IGTs and the Medical Care Trust Fund. There are a couple hospitals that do provide in, or entities that provide in the IGTs support this whole program. The hospitals will submit to us their application for this program, and by March 2nd, they get that to us, and then we turn around, do the calculations, and post it. This program started a year after the statewide residency program in 13-14. And then next, we move into some of the little newer programs we have for GME. These are proviso programs, and we just call them proviso because if you look at the GAA, there's proviso language associated with them, and we just follow that to distribute this money. And these are 3 programs have been added since 18-19, and they are funded with IGTs. The first one is what we call the High Tertiary Program, and it distributes funding to teaching hospitals that are highly specialized in tertiary services, and there's some other criteria that they have to meet, and they have to have greater than $10 million in charity care costs, and they have to provide highly specialized tertiary care, including, get a little bit of list here, comprehensive stroke, et cetera. Funding goes out to those hospitals. Then we have the Severe Deficit Program, and this program aims to address the declining GME in severe deficit physician specialties. This program funds up to $100,000 per FTE to residents' positions in urology, thoracic surgery, then a couple other programs. And then lastly, it's the Primary Care Program, which funds up to $150,000 per full-time resident in primary care and training in Medicaid regions with primary care demand greater than a supply of 25% or more. And then since 2021, so beginning in the current year, there's a couple more programs added. First one is a mental health, behavioral health program, which distributes funding for residents, fellows, or interns who rotate through mental health and behavioral health facilities, which which then helps out with the severe deficit of physicians trained in those areas. And then two more programs where unfortunately we did not receive the IGTs to fund these programs, so they are not funded in current year. And one is a primary care in Region 1. So this would go to one entity in Region 1, but IGTs, again, were not provided. And then the other was Tallahassee Memorial Healthcare Program. And then you can kind of see here just what the funding is for all these different programs that I just mentioned. So it's a total of $280 million that go to the Graduate Medical Education Program in 2021. And again, that the second item on there, the Statewide Medicaid Residency Program, the $97.3 million, that's the only program funded with general revenue, and it's roughly $37 million of that is associated with general revenue. Okay, this takes us to the Physician Supplemental Payment Program. So the Physician Supplemental Payment provides supplemental payments based on the calculation of the difference between the base Medicaid payment and the supplemental payment for allowable procedure codes. Payments are made to medical school faculty physician practice plans at eligible universities. There's roughly around 11 or 13 of them. Payments made through both fee-for-service program and then as a directed payment, which is goes through our Medicaid managed health plans. So the agency pays the health plans, and the health plans just directs that payment on to the physician practice plans. The state share is funded through IGTs, and this program began in state fiscal year 16-17. And then here's the two different, it's one program, but again, like I said, it's split between fee-for-service and the managed care piece, which is directed payment for a total of $315.6 million. Next, we have a smaller program. It's called the Multivisceral Transplant Program. This is a per Medicaid recipient global fee that is paid for approved transplants for intestine and multivisceral. So they have to get approved. There's one entity that does this. This is Jackson Memorial. And it's a global fee, so meaning that when the transplant is performed, they get coverage for 365 days after that transplant is done, and it is funded with IGTs for both a physician and a hospital inpatient reimbursement piece. This program began in 2009 and 2010. And in 2021, the funding for each actual transplant was increased a little bit in proviso. So it was $450,000 per transplant, and that was increased to $972,000, I believe, per transplant. So here's the funding, $7.4 million. So with that 972 per transplant, that's roughly about 7 transplants per year in this program. And you look on the average of the past few years, that's roughly what is out there to be done. Okay, this takes us to another program called the Florida Cancer Hospital Program. And this program provides supplemental payments to eligible Florida cancer hospitals that have to meet a certain criteria, and it's laid out in that 42 USC there. These providers are reimbursed up to their respective upper payment limit gap for inpatient and outpatient services. So they can't go above that gap. That's something that we calculate each year. It's called the upper payment limit, or UPL calculation, on the fee-for-service side. And so they get paid that difference there. Payments made through both the fee-for-service and as a directed payment through the managed Medicaid plans. And that the state share of this program is funded through IGTs. There are currently two providers that meet these criteria, or meet that criteria up above, and that's Moffitt and then University of Miami. And I believe last week you guys had a presentation from University of Miami, you know, Cancer Center, and they talked about that. But they didn't really speak about this funding that they received from us. But this program began in October 2017. And currently for 2021, it's $139.6 million. This is not used, it is using non-recurring dollars currently, so we have non-recurring authority. It does go away June 30th unless it's reappropriated. The governor did recommend that this program continues into 21-22.
Okay, Mr. Wallace, thank you. We'll take another round of questions here on whether it's the GME, the physician's supplemental payments, the multivisceral, or the Florida Cancer Hospital program. Any questions, members? Any questions? Representative Barnaby, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask specifically, can you explain to us what is the fee for service payments exactly? I've noted that there is $60 million for PSP, $24.3 million for cancer, and transportation, $35 million. What specifically are these fee-for-service payments, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for that question. It just means they're in our fee-for-service program. It's outside of managed care, so it's just a directed payment to these hospitals. We do not have to go through the managed care plans for it. So we have the fee-for-service program, we have the managed care program. This is just happening on the fee-for-service side.
Follow-up, you're recognized.
I guess I just wanted to know specifically, why are we paying millions of dollars? What are we getting? What are we paying $60 million? What service are they providing for these fees?
You're recognized.
Sure. Thank you for that question there. This is funded with IGTs, right? So the state share is coming from these entities to bring down federal match to get to them. So the medical school faculty physician practice plans have physicians on staff that are there. It's kind of similar to GME, but it's not. It's on the outside. They do treat Medicaid recipients as well in that program. So they're treating Medicaid recipients. And then your cancer hospitals are treating Medicaid recipients as well there too. So it's extra funding going to them for all these treatments for Medicaid.
Follow up?
I just want to say thank you so much for explaining that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, questions? Representative Duran, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to ask you, and you mentioned it earlier in here, that the GME, we started with maybe two, and now we're up to about eight. Can you maybe kind of elaborate a little bit on why we're seeing that kind of progression?
You're recognized.
Sure, thank you. Yes, I did say that. Thank you for that question. And so in 18-19, just additional proviso was added to the General Appropriations Act that laid out exactly what the agency needed to do to fund those additional programs. It was just something that came in during legislative session. So we had the first two that started. I know back in that time in 12-13 for the statewide residency programs, it was a big push of Governor Rick Scott at the time to actually form that program. And so there was a little bit of additional funding was added to that program. Some money was moved from the hospital inpatient line to develop that. So they stuck around for a while until 18-19, and then these additional ones just came in, and then the agency just had to go ahead and implement those programs.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to go back just so I understand. With respect to that $60 million that the representative just brought up a question on, I saw early, I think in here you mentioned that this is funded through IGT. So the state's share is really the funds that we collect from the local municipality or whatever that taxing district is, and then we just sort of direct it out, or is there any state GR that is actually a part of that?
You're recognized.
Thank you for that question. That program is just funded with IGTs only. There's no state GR used for it.
I have a question just to piggyback off of Representative Duran's question. Are there any available IGTs, that can be used in this program in lieu of general revenue?
So I guess you were probably referring to the graduate medical education program.
Yes,
the statewide
GME
program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There are potentially other IGTs out there to be used for this program, but who could contribute them? I'm not real sure exactly. Who would be able to do that? They would only want to put those IGTs in if it were to benefit, if there's a benefit for that. There's probably a way that it could be worked to make it happen, but it is, that you see there's a listing of hospitals that do receive that funding. So I'm not sure that each one of those hospitals, the 73 that we're at now, can all contribute IGTs.
Thank you. Representative Tobolsky, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Do you know why Jacksonville Memorial is the only hospital that competes with the visceral transplant program?
You're recognized.
Yep. Thank you for that question. This program, it's been around since 9-10, I believe I said. Early on, I think there may have been another entity doing it, but they have the capability to do it, is my understanding now. They're willing to do it, and they just, over the years, had just been the only one. I'm not sure really besides the history on there, but they've just been the only one from as far as I can remember.
Representative Skidmore, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wallace. I'm afraid my previous history is coming back to haunt me, and so I'm trying to remember some things. The GME programs where the IGTs are sent up and we draw down the additional dollars, is that supplemental to what the Medicare formulary does for residency programs?
Chairman. You're recognized.
Yep. Thank you for that question. Yeah, this is in addition to.
Excellent. Thank Medicaid. You. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, questions? Senator Altman, you're recognized for a question.
Just a question in general, IGTs. So a Medicaid waiver program, does it mandate that we make certain Medicaid matches that are in non-IGT programs? Or is it strictly these revenues that are raised by the local entities?
You're recognized.
Thank you for that. If I understand it right, these IGTs that come in are strictly for these programs right here that I'm laying out to you today.
Follow-up, you're recognized.
And it's used to match Medicaid. If we were to expand Medicaid, are you allowed to use IGTs to match that Medicaid program as well?
You're recognized.
I'm not sure how exactly that would work.
Well, right now, Medicaid IGTs are used to match the Medicaid match that's required under the Medicaid program we have now. If Medicaid were to go to 150% of poverty or the expansion of those eligible, would you be able to use IGTs to match that as well? That pool, if it were to grow to a larger income pool, would you be able to use IGTs to match that in the same type of formula?
Sure. You're recognized.
Okay. Thank you for that question. I'm not sure what the correlation between Medicaid expansion, which you're referring to, with the federal poverty levels versus supplemental payments. These are standalone. These are supplemental payments. IGTs come in to fund these programs only.
And they go toward Medicaid recipients. So those who qualify these programs would have to be Medicaid patients or Medicaid programs. I was just curious, and I can get with you later about that. If you were to expand Medicaid and made more people eligible, would they become eligible under this program? That was just kind of wondering about that.
I'm sure if you could, get with Representative Altman.
I'd be happy to meet with you later to discuss this for sure.
Thank you.
Okay.
Members, any questions before we move on? All right. Mr. Wallace?
Okay, so the next one we want to talk about is the Public Emergency Medical Transportation Program. This is our last of our current supplemental payment programs that we have. It's a program that is for eligible public emergency transportation providers for allowable costs that are in excess of other Medicaid revenue that the entities receive for services for Medicaid recipients. Payments are made through both the fee-for-service programs and then also the managed care plans through a directed payment. Now, they are funded with certified public expenditures on the fee-for-service side and then IGTs on the directed payment side through the managed care plan. The program began in October of 2015, and there are currently 81 providers participating. These entities do put in IGTs for the local cities, and they provide them for these 81 different providers. This program, you can see here, is a total of $89.7 million, and then split between the fee-for-service and the direct-to-payment through the managed care plan. And this is all laid out in our proviso language. Okay, now we'll talk about the new proposal, what's being proposed for the Hospital Directed Payment Program, or DPP program. So this is something that has been included in the governor's Florida LEADS budget. It's part of the implementing bill. So if you see the implementing bill, you'll see it laid out there a little bit. It's basically giving the agency authority to do this once federal CMS establishes it. And then it's out there for hospitals to provide services for Medicaid managed care enrollees. This will provide a directed payment to hospitals up to an amount of their Medicaid shortfall. Again, Medicaid shortfall is a difference between cost of providing the care to Medicaid eligible patients and the payments received for those services. So we can pay up to the amount of the max of the shortfall. A separate uniform rate will be established for inpatient and outpatient services and for the three identified provider classes. So there are three classes that are going to be established with this proposal. You got a private hospital class, a public hospital class, and then a class for cancer hospitals. The uniform percentage increase will be set up by Medicaid region, and we have 11 Medicaid regions, so each one would be separate here. And then within each region, the payment arrangement will direct payments equally to all hospitals within each class for hospital services provided by hospitals and paid by the managed care plans. So each hospital in the provider class within a region will have a uniform payment percentage. So it's a uniform payment amount. So each class and then within each region will have a uniform payment. That's how it has to work. Everything's got to be uniform. And this will be implemented as a directed payment through the managed Medicaid health plans. And federal CMS must approve this prior to implementation of the directed payment program. The other part of the program is that the state must go ahead and identify how the payment arrangement will advance at least one of the goals and objectives in a comprehensive quality strategy. So part of the submission to federal CMS for approval included some quality goals that has to be met for this program. So the payment arrangement must align with what the agency has at the goals, and three of them are cesarean sections, so it's a reduction in cesarean sections, potentially preventable hospital readmission reductions, and then healthcare associated infection reductions. And those are catheter-associated urinary tract infections and then central line-associated bloodstream infections. Those are the two that are the healthcare infections. So the quality goal improvement targets will be set, and then the regional rate will have to come up and be compared back to that target to see if the hospitals within that region in an aggregate meet that quality goal. And then the state share of this payment arrangement will be funded through provider assessments and a receipt of IGTs. So there will not be any general revenue for this program. A regional assessment structure will be implemented for the private provider class. So there will be a structure have to be developed for that private class. And then the assessment per region will be based on the amount needed to fund the cost of the rate increases to the hospitals in that area. And then here's the amount that's being proposed right now, $2.25 billion. This is total computable, right? So this is would it consist of both the federal share, which would be roughly of that number, depending on the FMAP, but it would be roughly $1.4 billion, and then the state share, roughly $870 million or so, and that state share would be coming from IGTs and then provider assessments. And then here's the last slide. I know it may be a little hard to see it, but this is taking everything I just showed you and rolling it up into one slide here to see the total funding, total amount. So earlier, at the very beginning, I told you of the current current programs that we have, like $2.23 billion in total computable, add on top of that the $2.25 for the directed payment program, you get a total for all supplemental payments, like $4.5 billion. And that's total computable, so that consists of the IGTs and other state share sources that we receive, plus the federal match. And Mr. Chairman, that concludes the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace, for that detailed presentation. I know you covered various topics, and again, we'd like to thank you for that very detailed presentation. Members, any questions? Our Vice Chair, Representative Yarborough, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Tom, for the informative presentation. We appreciate you being with us today. On the DPP program, the last one that you highlighted, can you clarify whether that includes all hospitals, including Class 3 behavioral health hospitals? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're recognized.
That would include all private hospitals, all public hospitals, and cancer hospitals. So Class 3 psychiatric hospitals, and this proposal is not being included.
It would be?
It's not, not being included currently in that proposal right there.
Okay.
Follow?
Okay, thank you. No, not at this time. Thank you.
Representative Duran, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to see if I can get some clarification on some of these aspects here. The first would be the separate uniform rate would be that a private hospital or a public hospital or a cancer hospital, they have what might be the difference between the cost and what the Medicaid is reimbursing. Each is going to have its own sort of negotiated rate, is what you're saying within this?
Mr. Chairman?
You're recognized. Yep.
Thank you for that question. Yeah, so how it would work is it's not really a negotiated rate, but it's a uniform, it's got to be a uniform rate for each of those classes, and each of those regions has to get that payment paid back to them, has to be the same, right? Same percentage payment, right? Paid to them. But it can be different between regions, can be different, and between the classes, that payment can be different.
Okay. Follow up, Ms.
Follow up, you're recognized.
Thank you. So the other question I had on this would be the timing and I guess the process in order for this to be established. And I guess what we're saying here is that the DPP program would be sort of just like the other several programs you just went through. We will be starting to see this yearly. But the timing for something like this, I think you all have to submit to CMS a proposal. What's the timing on them responding? Just because I see that you're adding it into this fiscal year's budget. And whether or not this even comes to fruition, you know, that's, I guess my concern is what's the timing look like on something like that becoming reviewed and accepted and then implemented?
Hey, thank you for that question, Representative. And I think this, to go off of that, I know last year AHCA submitted the request for approval. Could you give us kind of an update on what's the status of that request?
Sure, yeah, thank you for those questions. Yeah, we did. We went ahead and submitted to CMS. We have to submit through what's called the 438.6 template. It's just the federal approval process. And we submitted that back last November. So it went to CMS last November. And then in early January, CMS had came back with a first round of questions to us. We submitted those questions back to CMS at end of January. And then early February, so really I think maybe last week, they followed up with an additional question or two to us. So we're right now in the negotiating process, going back and forth with them and answering their questions. But in terms of approval, I don't really know when CMS will approve it, but I can just say we're getting, you know, going through that process now.
Okay. Representative Driscoll, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and please bear with me. Healthcare is a new area for me. So this directed payment program is something new that the state's never done before. Is that right?
Mr. Chair?
You're recognized.
That is correct.
Okay.
Follow up? You're recognized.
But we're anticipating that once we begin this program, it's something that will be recurring every year. Is that correct?
You're recognized.
Well, it will take legislative approval, legislative authority to do it, and if it's in there, we would continue it.
Okay. I don't understand.
Representative Skidmore, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wallace. In the region, all the hospitals participate, and do we have examples of the directed payment in other states that we can look to, or is this entirely new? It's kind of a two-part question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're recognized.
Thank you for that question. So each of the providers, the hospitals will be broken up between those provider classes, right? And so they would have to have the state share generated in order to participate in that program. Mm-hmm. But every hospital in that region, in that class, would get a payment. That's part of the deal. It has to be uniform, so they'd have to get that payment. My understanding is there is another state that has done something similar to this, and that is Texas.
Follow up, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really just a comment that I think that this is a tremendous vehicle for our hospitals to be able to draw down the federal funds that to help shorten that gap. I think that it will serve my county well. So thank you.
Members, questions? Questions? Mr. Wallace, I have several questions for you related to DPP. Among them, and it's kind of tied into Representative Duran's questions with regards to the IGT process within DPP. Can you describe how that IGT process will work for each class of hospital within the program?
Sure. Thank you for that question. So public hospitals already have access to IGTs, and they will be ready to go. They're ready to do this. Private hospitals, they will have to establish a provider assessment. So that assessment can be done on a local level, can it be done on the city level or on the county level. But again, that assessment would have to be uniform as well for all the hospitals within that local government.
Okay. And to follow up on that, for regions that currently do not have a local taxing district or local hospital taxing district, what will be the basis of their IGTs?
Okay. Thank you for that question. Very similar to what I just said in my previous response, they would have to generate an assessment within that local government entity. Okay. So that local city or the local county, they'll generate that assessment. That assessment will be what's used as that state share IGT funding source.
Okay. So those assessments will be all considered new assessments, correct?
That's correct.
All right. Members, questions? Questions, questions? Okay. Well, Mr. Wallace, thank you very much for that detailed presentation. Thank you certainly for answering all of our questions. I'm sure all of the members appreciate that, and I'm certain that they will also be reaching out to you, with more questions as we move through the process and we start to see more and more of these topics come up within our discussion. So. Thank you again for the detailed and very informative presentation. Again, we really appreciate it.
You're welcome, and I'm happy to, in the future here, if anyone's got any questions, follow up, feel free to reach out, and I'm happy to address anything.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay. Members, I know it was a lot of information, certainly between last committee meeting and certainly this committee meeting as well. Again, please make sure to go back, look at the videotape or go back and look at the slides. Really immerse yourself in these topics, because as we start moving into the budget process, certainly we're going to hear these topics come up. And I want to make sure everyone's very familiar with them once we get, into the weeds on a lot of these budgetary issues that will be coming before our committee. So, with that being said, I know that I've met with the majority of the committee. I think there's probably less than a handful of you that I have not been able to meet with, but I know that we are in the process of scheduling something. So I also wanted to thank you for taking the time to meet with me. Again, I am here to help you. So is our staff director, Brian Clark. Again, please make sure, don't hesitate, to reach out. As the process moves along, we're certainly going to have more and more intense debate and discussion on a lot of these topics, obviously because of the current situation that we're in. And so I want to make sure everyone is as informed as possible before we make any decisions. So thank you again. With that, let's see. Hearing no, Representative Barnaby moves that we adjourn. Hearing no objection, this meeting is adjourned.